I'm in the Unionist Hall here in...
Unionist Hall, or sometimes we call it the Unionist Office in Regal Pass in Enniskillen.
Okay, and I'm talking to Stuart Brooker. Tell me, where did you come from originally?
Where did I come from originally? Yes. Well, I am originally a Fermanagh man, Morris. I'm born and bred Fermanagh, but my parents, my mother is local. Her maiden name was Elliot. But my dad came from the south of England. And what brought him here? Well, he came here in the war years. He was serving in the army. And he was injured over in England in a... I suppose you call it an air raid or whatever, yeah, and not seriously injured, but it meant that he wasn't then able to do overseas service. So he was sent to a place called Ely Lodge, which is just down the road from here, a few miles to the west of Enniskillen, where they were training troops for the D-Day beaches, and he was a sergeant instructor. And then he obviously met my mother, as many of the soldiers did in those days. You know, there were lots of soldiers here, and he met my mum, and... They subsequently got married just after the war, and went back to England to live for a while, but he liked it so much here that they decided to come back and set up home here, and then the rest is history, really. So that's why.
Okay.
The name is not a... Brooker is not a Fermanagh name.
No, it is not. Yeah. So, but Elliot is.
Elliot is, yes.
What part of Enniskillen did your mother live in?
My mother lived just out near Ely Lodge, again, about four or five miles west of Enniskillen, sort of towards Donegal from Enniskillen. And she's one of the Elliots out there, the Elliot connection. Well, it's a family that's been around for quite a long time. Okay. There's an Elliot connection, a Ferguson connection, and a Scott connection. Those are all well-known names in our area.
So your date of birth is?
My date of birth is the 31st of May, 1958.
I know your father was in the army, and he was wounded, or at least he suffered...
Some injuries.
Some injuries, and he was here. Now, did he keep... training?
No, well, he would have been demobbed after the war, sort of in the late 40s. He would have been demobbed because they were all conscripted, obviously. And the only way that you couldn't serve during the war was to have a protected occupation.
Yes.
Which actually my other uncle, which is the last survivor of the family, now 95 years young, still lives in the south of England. And he worked on a big farm farm enterprise, and he couldn't wear uniform because he was in a protected occupation.
I see.
Because feeding the nation was as important as taking up arms to defend it. So anyway, Dad was demobbed after that, and he worked for an oil company in London. He was a draftsman by trade. And there's quite an interesting little story, if you don't mind me digressing, about how he became a draftsman. Because my dad grew up in a very ordinary family. I mean, my grandfather was a farm labourer, or worked on the same farm as my uncle did subsequently. And, I mean, they were just a very ordinary family, living in a cottage, and really didn't have much means as such. Just ordinary people, like many of the folk here in Ireland were ordinary people. They didn't have much money. But my dad's family, my granny and granddad, were very friendly with a lady called Mrs. Littlechild, who lived in Brighton, which was nearby. And Mrs. Littlechild would have had some money. She wouldn't have been very rich, but she had some money. But she seen my father's talent at a young age, that he had good hands. He was good with his hands. And she, when Dad came to leave school, as he would have at 14 or 15 or 16 or whatever in those days, she said, no, I think he should continue. And she paid to send him to a college called Varndean College in Brighton, which still exists.
I see, yeah.
And he trained in art and various things and became a draftsman by trade. And that was his trade then. He was a draftsman and a mapper. He could draw maps, he could draw plans for houses, etc., etc.
And so tell me, your own schooling, first of all, you, what denomination were you
Well, I'm a Protestant, and I was brought up in the Church of Ireland denomination.
Okay. And so you went to a Protestant school, and you were educated in that way. How, when you were going to school, was there... any bias in the school against... Catholics at that time. Did you find any kind of divide?
I think probably not so much. I mean, I still live in a rural area, and you know, I have found all through my life, and still find that, you know, we have always lived as good neighbours together. I suppose you would, Morris, have had, you know, a bit of a Protestant Catholic thing, you know, but there was nothing really divisive or meaningful in that, you know. I mean, we lived with our Catholic neighbours, and there might have been a bit of banter. And I suppose, as a young lad going to primary school, and then subsequently on to I went to Portora Grammar here for the remainder. I'm just trying to think of the dates now, but sort of around that time I would have been in primary school right up until 69-70, and then came on to what we used to call town school in those days. Yeah. And that was around the time the Troubles broke out, 69-70. Yeah. So there was, I suppose, a bit of a divisiveness, yes, amongst youngsters and people. But having said that, there was never any bitterness or bad feeling in the area that I lived in. I mean, we lived together. Okay. And still do, as good friends and neighbours.
And so the obvious differences might be in the games, for example.
Yeah.
One side you had the GA, and then maybe the other side the soccer games, and one referred to the other as the foreign games. So did you find that? Did you kind of tend to not want to go to matches or get involved in sport?
Well,
in that way?
It's interesting now, and my mind then flashes immediately back to being a young lad around the area, and we had a sort of a makeshift football pitch just down the road. I can picture it in my mind's eye still, which was, it was just on a local farmer's field who had allowed us to go and play football. But everybody played football. We all played football there.
Yeah.
And I don't really have any memories of any divisiveness in games.
Yes.
I don't have any particular memories of GAA or its place in the area. I'm sure, yes, there would have been, still is, a GAA team down in Derrigonley, which is 3 miles down the road. But never remember much talk or chat about that. We used to all play soccer on this pitch, and everybody played soccer.
Yes.
You know, it didn't matter who you were. And so that would be my abiding memory. And I think that, again, sort of links back to the fact that we were you know, basically a very happy community, and we lived at peace with each other.
Yeah.
In a sense.
Yeah.
Although I suppose it is fair to say there was an underlying problem. These troubles were going on, and that, you know, it does sort of naturally bring division, doesn't it, because Roman Catholics have their way of life and what they did, and they went to their chapel, which was just, I mean, we could see it from the front door of our house, and we went to church on a Sunday, but there was never any disrespect for each other in that way. Not at all, but we had different ways of life, hadn't we? Yes, we had different ways of life in that sense, yeah.
Yeah, and so so that would have given you a kind of a, I suppose, the biased at that stage, you know, that you would have been watching television, and you would have been looking at the shooting and the bombing, and you were saying, well, how did that affect you? Were you affected by the Troubles?
Well, I think so, Morris. I think, I suppose, everybody was, but certainly I was, in that, you know, you watched TV, you listened to the radio, you read the papers, and you saw all these things happening on a basically almost a daily basis, really, in those days. You know, there were terrible times. And I suppose, you know, it made an impression on your life. And I think it would have, I suppose, be fair to say that, you know, it introduced an element maybe of mistrust. You know, who could you trust, and what was happening around you with your, you know, we were the Protestant population, then you had the Roman Catholic population. In those days, then you had the B specials, and then very quickly into the Troubles, the formation of the Ulster Defence Regiment, and then the Army came along, although they were all really all came from England, you know, the soldiers came from there. But and the RUC, I suppose, was predominantly a Protestant police force, it's fair to say. I mean, and so was the Ulster Defence Regiment. However, there were quite a number, significant number,
okay.
of Roman Catholics served in both those forces, and they were very good people.
Okay.
You know.
Oh, and Stuart, what did you do for a living yourself? What were you doing at the time?
At the time, well, I was, I suppose when the troubles broke out, I was at school, and I would have, I left school around sort of 76, 77, and somewhere there, I would have been coming up to 18, 19. I did A-levels. Didn't go to college, or it wasn't really one for college, so I went to work, and I actually started working the Forest Service as a trainee forester, and I did that for a while, but just found that it really wasn't for me. And soon after that, I noticed there was a job in the Department of Agriculture, which was based here in Enniskillen, well, it's still here, of course, the department, and I got a job with them, worked for them then for quite a number of years, sort of out cattle testing and various things that the department did. And I did that for quite a long time. Then after that, that came to an end. I was employed in what was called an industrial grade.
Okay.
And that sort of came to an end as, you know, things evolve and change, and our jobs weren't there anymore. And then I moved off into sales.
I see.
And I went into animal feed sales because I had such a knowledge of the farming community in Fermanagh.
And so did you travel around?
I travelled around a lot, yes, all over the county. Yes, I would have a pretty detailed knowledge of the county, roads-wise and people-wise. Yes,
okay, but did you travel down south at any stage?
A little. When we were youngsters, we would have always gone to Rosnaula and County Donegal for our holidays. But then with the advent of the Troubles, that became not so easy because my dad joined, you know, going back to your earlier question, my father joined the Ulster Defence Regiment when it came into being and served for a number of years in it. And then, you know, when you donned a uniform, you had to be careful about your movements. That's just the way it was. So going south wasn't easy.
Okay, so was it like a war zone area? I mean, did you get a sense that, you know, that you were in danger all the time, that you had to be alert?
Oh, yes. I mean, I subsequently joined the Ulster Defence Regiment myself at about in 1976, and I would have been aged 18 at that time, and I donned a uniform then. And when you donned a uniform, you know, that element of danger.
Did you feel a marked man then?
Yes, you did. I mean, everybody was marked. Well, in the sense that, I mean, I was never aware of actually being marked as a target.
Yeah.
But then you never knew, Morris, whether you were or not. You know,
with
the fact that you donned the uniform, you became, in a sense, a marked man. Yes, you did.
And did you look under your car each morning? Or is that something you would do?
Absolutely, yeah. I can remember very clear memories then, you know, of getting a little older, got married, and we had children of our own, and all through those years, checking the cars. We had two cars at home. My wife had a wee red Mini, one of the old Minis. I had to go out, out and check the cars every morning to make sure that everything was safe for her to take the kids and whatever, you know. Yeah, so it became a way of life. It was something that was normal.
Imagine.
Not a funny word, you know. Yeah. It was just normal to check the car. It was normal for me after this interview was over, Morris, to go back to my van parked in Enniskillen and check under it.
Imagine.
Yes, we did that routinely.
Yeah.
You were trained to do that, and you were trained to, you know, be careful of setting patterns and just be careful of all the things that made it easy for someone to attack you. So, yeah, you were under threat 24/7. And, of course, as a part-time soldier, we lived in our communities. We didn't have the safety of a barracks. We went home at night.
Yeah.
We went home from work.
A member, what was your brief?
What do you mean exactly?
What exactly did you do in a day?
What did I do in a day? Yeah. Well, I suppose normal day was up in the morning, went to work. I was working in the department at that time and then subsequently in sales, but check the cars and things, headed off to work.
But wearing the uniform, being, say, an Ulster Defence Force member, what did you do in a day?
Well, we had a pattern. You belonged to the structure. There was a battalion structure, a company structure, and within the company were platoons and sections. And then I was assigned to a section of eight men, and we were then assigned a certain amount of duty to do every month,
I see.
Which was every sort of third night or something like that, and you did various things. Like, we did guard duties, we did patrol duties, and training. Yeah. And that was a pattern throughout the week, throughout the month. Yeah. And you did just sort of what was allotted to you to do.
Imagine. And were you, did you carry a gun?
In those days, latter days we didn't, but in those days we actually had our weapons at home. I had a weapon, a rifle, in the house, which was actually broken down. You had to take certain parts out of it and hide them so that if the weapon was stolen, it was no use to anyone. But the story behind that was that we could deploy very quickly, and often did. If something happened, we had a thing called a call-out system. And what happened was that if there was an incident somewhere in our area, or, well, particularly in our area, because we tended to focus on our own areas more so at that time, the call was initiated from on high, and it came down, and it cascaded down.
Yes.
And it cascaded down right down to what my corporal, who looked after our section, and right down to my phone line. And I would have got a call to, I would have just been told that I was being called out. That's all. I knew where to go. We had a place to go in the local area where we met, and then we further subdivided. So we could deploy very quickly. I could be at my place. Well, I mean, if I was at home having my tea or whatever, I would probably be on the road ready to go in 10 minutes.
Imagine.
Yeah,
yes.
I just picked up my rifle, pulled on some bits of uniform, and you were gone.
Okay.
Did
you uncover any, I mean, were you involved in any skirmish at any time?
No, I was never directly involved in sort of any being directly attacked or shot at or da-da-da. No, I don't recall anything like that. But then, you know, going back to earlier in the conversation, you actually never knew really what was going on around you. You could have been very close to something.
Yeah. But because it was all extremely hit and run,
yeah,
incidents.
But I mean, to say that somebody actually aimed a rifle at me and fired a shot at me, I'm not aware of that ever happening. No, not me personally.
But did you come across something that, say, disturbed you? You know, that, you know, you, maybe finding after a shooting or after a bombing or after, you know, were you traumatized in any sense?
Well, not sure about traumatized, but maybe we were on without knowing. But, you know, we were involved in lots of follow-up operations. Maybe an incident happened, you were called out and you were pretty close to the scene. One that strikes me very much, but actually I didn't attend with uniform on, was because my uncle, who also served in the Ulster Defence Regiment, was involved with intelligence and various things around that and that sort of end of things, but at a local level very much. But I remember him ringing me on the, it was on a Sunday afternoon, and there had been an ambush out at Garrison where one of our lads, actually Alan Ferguson, actually was killed in the ambush. And he said, I'm just going out to have a look, you know, and mm-hmm. would you like to come with me?
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted some company, I suppose. I says, yeah. So we jumped in, the way we went. And I remember, you know, actually standing on the scene, on the road. And one of my abiding memories, Morris, was looking at the road and thinking, why is the road white? Why does it appear to be white and not like black sort of tarmac at him? And why that was there was all the strike marks, all the bullets that the IRA had fired at the patrol. They were actually firing quite low that day and were hitting the road. And they turned the road white. It was like there was hailstones on the road. It was white. That sort of sticks in my mind. Isn't that funny now, as I sit talking to you, and then you could see places where they had hit the clay and sort of... It was quite a sort of put you back on your heels a bit when you actually stood there and just imagined that a couple of hours earlier... You know,
that there was a hail of bullets.
There was a hail of bullets coming down onto that road, you know, just really trying to kill everybody that was in their way, and did actually kill one guy and seriously injured another guy.
Yeah.
So that's one, you know, and I suppose it's fair to say, Morris, that does traumatise you in a sense. You probably didn't think about it in that way at the time.
Of course.
But when you look back now, you think, gosh, it was quite a shock just to stand there.
And is it easy then to turn around and to forgive somebody who did that then? I mean, does that become instilled in you that they're the enemy? You know, that, you know, obviously that the IRA are the enemy. regardless of peace treaty or peace negotiations.
I suppose it does to a great extent. However, you know, I suppose now we have, we use the terminology moved on, but I'm not sure any of us really know what that means. But, you know, time has moved on anyway, because time does move on and we've got to go with time. But I think, yes, I mean, the IRA as such were very definitely enemy at the time. But then, you know, we still had to maybe make a distinction between the IRA and the Roman Catholic population, or people who were maybe deemed to support the IRA, and there were some, but then there were others who didn't, you know. So that was a bit of a balancing act, and you sort of had this sort of these troubles and the IRA attacking you, and then you had normal life as well. And I suppose we never really stopped to think about it, but it was quite a difficult time. It was a difficult, interesting, complex
time,
you know. But yeah. But yes, the IRA, I mean, they very clearly were the enemy and were intent on killing people. So, I mean, that was a very real thing at that time.
How do you stand yourself by that? I mean, do you see yourself as Irish or part of the United Kingdom, or do you see yourself as British or Irish?
Firstly, British, I have to be honest. I mean, I see myself as a British citizen. But yet we have this uniqueness of living in Ireland, and I suppose, yes, we're Irish as well, so it's a strange one. We probably can't work it out ourselves, never mind anybody else, but I see myself primarily as British. I mean, I live in Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland's part of the United Kingdom, and I hold a British passport and so on.
Okay, do you have an Irish passport?
I don't actually, no. I suppose I've never really seen a need for having an Irish passport, but I mean, my primary allegiance would be to the UK, to Britain. Yeah.
Do you see the South as another country then? Like, if you drive down, do you feel that you're in another country when you go across that border?
I think you do, in a sense, yes, because it's a different country, and yet. Strangely nowadays, wasn't so easy in those days, but nowadays I would love going south and seeing all the different places and meeting some wonderful people. I think there are some wonderful people in the south of Ireland. I know many, many people down there, and they're wonderful people. I think as an individual I would see a difference, yes. I mean, I still see Northern Ireland very much as part of the UK and the Republic of Ireland as another country. And yet we're still on the one island. Yeah, you know.
Yeah, and as you say, it takes a while to work
concept.
It out. Yeah, and does that become challenging sometimes to, you know, if you're in, I don't know whether you follow rugby or not, but if you're watching a rugby match and Ireland are playing England, who are you cheering for?
Well, we're probably cheering for Ireland, aren't we? And I have two youngsters, I have three children. My eldest girl works for a company in Northern Ireland. I don't know whether I can say the name of it or not, but she works for Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
And then my other two youngsters are in the forces. My second daughter is in the army, and my youngest lad, Jonathan, is in the Royal Navy. That was their chosen careers. They chose those careers themselves. Melanie has been all over the world. She's been in Afghanistan and all the recent things. She's been in Iraq and all that sort of stuff. Peacekeeping missions. And was in Afghanistan during the time of the war. She was out there a few years ago. So, you know, she's done all that. But that's, as she says to us, that's her job and that's what the army does. My son is, he's currently in the Middle East on sort of, what you would call it, peacekeeping duties. His ship is there at the moment. He'll be there for until Christmas. But getting back to the point about the rugby, you know, they're both sort of based in England, but yet they're Ireland supporters, you know, rugby Ireland supporters. So. Very definitely Ireland supporters. So there you are. That's another strange quirk that we have, isn't it? As a people.
Well, it's kind of working it out. But it's very much about the way you were brought up, and it's very much the way that you yourself learned from your parents, and now you're passing your information, your stories on to your children, now your adult children.
Yeah.
So I mean, do you think it'll take another generation before it can heal completely? I mean, because you know, your father and mother must have been biased at that stage, you know. And then you weren't, so you became hardened as well because you lived through the troubles.
Yeah.
But then, how do you share that with your own family then?
Yeah, well, gosh.
That's a big question.
It's a big question. I'm just going to say it is a big question, but there's no other way to ask it without making it a big question. But yeah, I suppose my grandparents and my parents and subsequently myself and my wife, you know, where we were all in a generation where we lived with troubles and all these things, and it affects whether you like it or not. It affects, doesn't it? We've talked about that earlier, but firstly, I think yes, it will take another generation. I think at least for things to evolve or change or settle or whatever word you want, you know. And I think it's moving towards that. But and I think there are a lot of good people in both communities who do work quietly behind the scenes to make things happen. For example, I've seen a lot of it in recent years, particularly here in Fermanagh, where, you know, I'm a senior member of the Orange Order. I've always been very passionate about the Orange Order. I think it's a wonderful organisation, and yet there are others who see different angles of it, which we as an organisation don't like either. We don't like some of the things that our members do. That's a whole different area that we could get into for an hour. But we as an institution in Fermanagh here have been working very hard. We did a community audit recently. We have been working to sort of try to cross the community divide. Now, when I say that, I mean, we're not an organisation where our membership is limited by what we are. And I mean, it's a Protestant organisation. Mm. But yet there's lots of good work where we can reach out. And we have been really very proactively doing that. And we're getting a great degree of reciprocation.
I see. Yeah.
For example, I'll give you an example. Back at the end of last year, you know, we're in the decade of centenaries. We had 2016 last year. World War One, I suppose, the Battle of the Somme and so on, is the one that comes first to our minds, maybe as a Protestant people, if that sounds fair. Although there were, I mean, goodness sake, the number of Roman Catholic soldiers who fought and died in the Irish divisions, they're phenomenal as well. You know, people sometimes tend to forget that, but it's been brought back to light. But anyway, we had the Easter Rising last year as well, you see. And we thought, we have formed a thing called a churches group where we're with our mainstream Protestant churches, although we have had some tentative links with the Roman Catholic Church as an organisation. That's something that will take maybe time to develop relationships and so on over time. But we formed a churches group and we decided that we would look at the decade of centenaries. So when 2016 came up, we thought, well, you know, we've got to look at all the centenaries. You know, we can't look at Battle of the Somme, but we've got to also look at the Easter Rising. These are all historical facts. They all happened. So what we did as an organisation, it was quite sort of a high risk thing in a sense, was we ran an event. And we had Senator Michael McDowell came up, and we had Brian Feeney. And Brian is, I mean, if Brian was sitting here, I mean, we would think he would quite openly say he's not a particular friend of the Orange Order. But we had him as one of the speakers. We had Michael McDowell, and we had it chaired by Alex Kane. And we looked at the Easter Rising. And we organised that, the Orange Institution in Fermanagh, as an organisation, and our church's group organised that.
That's interesting. So there is a handout.
That was quite a marked... Mm. I mean, and I said in my opening remarks, I'm not sure that we as an organisation have ever done anything like that before. Yeah. It was quite a step for the Orange Order to organise an event looking at the Easter Rising.
It was, indeed.
But yet I think we have to do these things. We have to challenge ourselves and we have to...
Well, it all happened in the island of Ireland.
And it did. And yet it was a very successful event. We had a very large attendance. I think there were over 300 people turned up to hear the presentation and the talks and the discussion and question and answer. And we had, and I'll just say, we had every shade of political opinion you can imagine.
Yeah.
There.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah.
We had everything from the mildest form of unionism to the most extreme form of republicanism, Sinn Féin, were there.
And that wouldn't have happened 10 years ago.
No.
Or even 5 years ago, I'd say.
No, probably. Well, we were starting to develop our programmes then, but certainly not 10 years ago.
So how long were you a member?
Of the institution?
Yeah, of the institution.
Since about 1976. What does that leave me?
Oh, my goodness.
Just over 40 years.
Yeah. 40 years?
Yeah.
And so what are the changes?
What are the changes?
When you came in first?
Gosh. Do you mean in the institution?
In the institution itself. Yeah. You know, first of all, who introduced you to... So can you recall?
Well, I joined for the reason that a lot of us would have joined because of family connection and tradition. I mean, my dad was in it, my uncles, my family. It was a family tradition. So it was a natural thing that you sort of joined the
Followed Irish, suit.
Followed suit and joined.
Okay.
Yeah, and it was something just that you did as a young lad in those days.
Okay.
But I've always been very passionate about it. I've always loved the Orange Institution. I think very, very genuinely we are a very good organisation. We do a lot of good things that people never hear about. But there you are, that's life, isn't it? Good news doesn't sell papers. But
then, at the same time, you're a political organisation in a sense. You hold very strong opinions, ideas.
We're basically a religious organisation, you know, and we are biblically based. We are a Reformation organisation, a biblically based Christian organisation. That's where all our foundations are. But you say we are a political organisation, but you maybe think of it differently than I do, in that we're not actually a political organisation. Mm-hmm. We're not a political party, but then we're full of people who are interested in politics.
Exactly, but that's what I mean. Obviously, you're not a party, but you do. It's just like the GAA, I suppose, or politically in that sense, you know, that you're an organisation that would carry the William of Orange flag, and that you would march and so on. But as you say, there are a lot of things happening behind the scenes that you do that people don't. Like what now? I mean,
we're obviously very much a community-based organisation. So we're in every community. We have our halls and our people in every community. And so first and foremost, we are good members of the. We are good day-to-day members of the community, and we do a lot of good in our. As individuals and collectively in our churches and our local organisations, many of us belonging to organisations that are not only Protestant but across community.
Yeah.
We do a substantial amount of charity fundraising. Last year we gave it away this year because we're always a year behind, but I mean we in this county we give away every year somewhere between £25,000 and £30,000 to charity.
Mm.
We raise that every year. By various means, and give it to charity right across the community. We don't make where that money is going. Catholic, Protestant, to be blunt about it, doesn't concern us.
I see.
We give it to needy causes.
Yeah.
This, for example, this year our headline charity this year is the Northwest Mountain Rescue Team. They rescue every.
So you're very passionate about it, really.
I am very passionate about it. Yeah, I mean, it's been very much part of my life, and I think we are a good organisation, and we have lots of wonderful people in it. Yes, there are blemishes and there are problems.
Yeah,
I don't have to tell you or anybody that if you read the papers or watch the news. But tiny minorities.
Yeah,
I mean, right across Northern Ireland and further afield, it's a very good organisation.
Yeah.
And I've come up through the ranks now from joining then to being the County Grand Master in Fermanagh at the moment.
Oh, are you?
Yes, so I'm actually...
Oh, what does that make you?
It makes me the most senior Orange man in the county.
I see. And so being the most senior...
So I'm sort of the boss, although we're not a paid organisation, but I mean, we're entirely voluntary. But
right.
And then just on... Sorry, before you go to that point, just also was recently appointed as an assistant Grand Master by the Grand Master of Ireland. So I'm actually working at Grand Lodge level as well now. So so my work has not only taken me into the wider county, it's taken me into a bigger picture
and
as an institution.
To achieve that accolade, what did you do?
I couldn't pinpoint anything. It's just a progression more. It's just years of service and just doing things and just working your way up and having an interest and being passionate. And I think not only in this walk of life but another walk of life, you know, people are picked up for what they do, and you know, there's a good man for that job.
Yeah,
sort of thing. Okay. I mean, I haven't sat any exams or done anything like that. There isn't any formal structure. Okay, you need to come up through the ranks and so on. I mean, you've got to progress and learn your trade, if you know what I mean. But I mean, you don't.
Does that carry?
You don't.
A lot
you don't
baggage?
Have to pass an exam or a degree or anything.
Does that carry a lot of baggage? Baggage, as in responsibilities.
Oh yes, it does. It does. Well, I mean, I suppose when you're when you become more senior, then you know you're more in the limelight, and then you're more up for being a target for people, and they want to have a pop at you about what you said and things, sort of things. And I mean, recently we've had some letters in the paper about over the 12th of July, and we get that sort of stuff. But it goes with the territory. Yeah. As you come up more into the limelight, and the papers talk to you, and maybe you comment on a certain issue, and I have been known to do that. You have views on an issue, and it goes into the press, and you know,
of course,
and it's just, I suppose, like being a politician. A politician says something, and then they're target practice for the week, aren't they? You know.
Yeah. So, has it changed much since I think I might have asked you that
you
initially?
Did, yes, yeah. Didn't. Well, I think it has changed to the extent that it was. Don't know how I would describe this really.
Is it more open now? Is it open to
maybe
other members of the society to join? Would it be possible for Catholics to join, for example?
No, it's not, you see, because it's strictly... it is possible for a Catholic to join. And I actually have a member in my own lodge who was a former Roman Catholic, but he converted to the Protestant faith. I mean, it is a Protestant organization, Morris, and there's no secret in that fact. And I mean, you really have to, you've got to commit to the Protestant Reform, what we call the Protestant Reformed faith.
Okay.
And that's really the very tenet, the very foundation of the organization.
But it isn't in any way a secret organization. It's very open in that sense.
It's not a secret organization, but it's maybe it's an organization with secrets.
Maybe closed doors and lots of secrets.
Whereas we meet behind closed doors and all that sort of thing. But then many organizations do that as well, but has it changed? I think it was maybe more, I don't know whether, maybe it was a bit more formal and a bit more sort of rigid maybe in the older days. I think it has become a more
with symbolism and that kind of thing.
I think it's more of an open organization too, and I think that, you know, albeit slowly, I think wider society are seeing us now, and I think particularly in this county we've seen it, where we are very much seen as being very much part of the scene, part of the community, and wanting to play our part.
Of course.
And that's good.
Yeah.
And so I think that's, we have certainly evolved in that respect over the years.
Stuart, I see this as probably an introduction recording. I'd like to talk to you again, and I'd like you maybe to introduce me to some of your members, I could talk to some of your members, and that would be lovely.
Absolutely. I mean, we're very keen to tell our story.
Good.
We are very keen to tell our story, because it's something that we have been very bad at.
Okay.
Is telling our story. We've always said, we don't want to tell anybody about us, but we should share.
Of course.
And tell our story. So. And then if you share your story and talk to people like yourself, you can understand better who and what we are.
Stuart Brooker, thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm just recalling a story with Morris here. It came to mind during our discussions when we were just reviewing the content of my interview, and it brought to mind a story of a Sergeant Hugh McCormick, who was murdered at the Grand Monastery during the Troubles. And I have got to know his wife in recent years. She's been involved in a remembrance service out at our church, and we've just become... acquaintances and friends, in a sense, and I also know her son very well, David McCormick, and recalling the day that he was murdered, and the story that she actually was out. We were having a rehearsal for a remembrance service a couple or 3 years ago out at my local church, and we had invited Anne out as an RUC widow to lay the wreath on that Sunday in the church, and we invited her over for a cup of tea, because we always have a sale of work over at the hall on the same day, just by coincidence, on that Saturday. And she sat down, and just sort of without any prompting, she started to tell us this story, and we all just fell silent and listened to her story. And it was really, really touching, really moving story about what happened on the day. And they had gone to Mass at the Grand on their Sunday morning, as they usually did, as a family, Hugh and Anne and David. And there is another brother, I don't recall his name, they were all there. And they were coming out of the Grand Monastery, supposed to go home after the service, and she noticed standing over to one side a guy wearing a duffel coat with his head down. And she said it sort of struck her, you know, I wonder who he is or what is he doing, you know, why is he standing there?
Yeah.
So they moved on out onto the car park, and David was right at his father's shoulder, walking towards the car. And this guy, all of a sudden, moved towards Hugh. He drew a handgun from his pocket and shot Sergeant McCormick. And he fell to the ground right beside David, at his feet, literally. And just within, I suppose I was going to say within a minute or two, but probably within a matter of seconds, another car came screaming into the car park. With a guy sort of hanging out through the window and brandishing a rifle.
Mm-hmm.
And the it turned out in the subsequent... You want to stop there?
Yeah,
just picking up again where the Sergeant McCormick had been shot.
Yeah.
This guy shot him with a handgun and he had fallen. And immediately into the car park came another car. But she described it as almost sort of screaming down the car park. And out of the window was a guy with a rifle, and the way we would describe it is he was holding the weapon in the high prone position, which is sort of up into the air, and I'm showing Morris what I mean at the moment. He had it up into the air like this and was sort of shouting and making a lot of loud noise, the guy hanging out of the car. I don't know how you would describe that, but I understood it from her to be sort of someone who was almost... deranged or just sort of shouting and screaming.
Yeah.
They drove right down beside Sergeant McCormick. The car stopped. The gunman got out and basically finished Sergeant McCormick off, made sure he was dead.
Why did they want to kill him so badly?
Well, I think the obvious reason at the time, Morris, was that he was obviously a member of the RUC, a sergeant, a senior policeman. But he was also a Roman Catholic.
Okay. So was it many years later that you heard that story?
Oh, yes. Well, I only heard that story, and as I said, listened to Mrs. Anne McCormick recounting that in such a sort of meaningful way.
Yeah.
It was really, I mean, we all fell silent when she started to talk about recounting the events of the day.
Yeah.
And that was about 3 years ago. So I'll say 2015.
Yeah.
Which was what? 30 odd years later,
yeah.
I had really heard that story, really heard the story.
Yeah.
From his wife, who was there with him at the time. It turned out afterwards, you know, when due process took place, that it was Seamus McElwain who was the gunman who was in the car. And of course, he was famous or infamous at the time as a fairly ruthless gunman.
Yeah.
And had been involved in a lot of murders around the border, but I mean that's fact and well proven, you know. But a very interesting story, very touching, and have even discussed it since, not with Anne, because I wouldn't presume to discuss it with her unless she volunteered that, because it's obviously something that she feels very much. But I did speak to her son David about it afterwards. I know David quite well, and he told me about it as well, and it was quite a day.
Mm-hmm.
For the family. So I just thought I would share that story with Morris. It just came to light out of nowhere a few minutes ago, and I'm sharing it with him now. And
okay, well, thank you.
I think it's a very important one.
Telling me that.